You may think that people with the smallest incomes have the simplest economies. But even in the poorest African communities, credit, insurance, investment, they all exist.
And if we're talking about people who are landless and don't have wealth, it's very hard for them to pledge collateral to back it up.
And that's where social collateral within the community comes into play.
People are not alone. They are embedded into families and extended families. So that suppose that I don't repay the loan you gave me, maybe I'm no longer around to be punished, but some of my family members will be. I am Eliana La Ferrara, and I'm a professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. I do research in development economics and political economy.
Eliana La Ferrara is an award-winning economist whose work has helped us understand how the economics of low-income people in Africa are deeply interwoven into the social fabric and norms of their communities. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with La Ferrara to discuss her research and how she came to focus on some aspects of development that are often overlooked.
So I've read that your career choices were very influenced by your early travels in Africa. Can you tell me a bit about that? Was that during your studies that you went to Africa?
So my first trip to Africa was when I was, I think, maybe 21 or 22. Yeah. And I went as a volunteer. Mm-hmm. And I went to a country that at the time was called Zaire, currently the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mobutu Sese Seko was still the dictator at the time. Mm-hmm. And I spent a summer in the middle of the forest in North Kivu. And it was really a life-changing experience for me because it was the first time for me that I saw poverty, but poverty with a lot of dignity, a lot of people working hard and living a fulfilling life in their own way. But it gave me a strong interest in Africa because there was not much research in the absence of reliable data. And later on in grad school, I was interested in African development and in particular on the role that informal transactions played in the absence of markets. For example, when you talk about insurance or credit, traditionally the poorest in these societies did not have access to credit or formal insurance. But then I realized that there were many informal ways in which people helped each other. And reading up from anthropology and sociological studies, I came across the role of kinship and ethnic groups, inheritance norms like matrilineal kinship systems. And all of these really tied very nicely with the formal modeling that I was interested in terms of credit. And so I ended up trying to merge the two approaches.
So you're talking about people lending to each other or redistributing money within families, that kind of idea?
Yes, exactly. And if you think about how when you model these lending and borrowing, what are the principles? The principles are that whoever the lender is, they're only going to give a loan if they have a reasonable guarantee that the loan is going to be repaid. And so what happens if you think about how, social structure ties into this is that people are not alone. They are embedded into families and extended families in many of these societies. So that suppose that I don't repay the loan you gave me, maybe I'm no longer around to be punished, but some of my family members will be. And then the lender can threaten to exclude these other family members from future loans or even shun them, on a social level. And this would prevent the one who originally got the loan from not repaying because they care about the fact that their extended family has access to economic opportunity.
So it's like a social insurance plan that's embedded in the fact that everybody knows each other and you're trying to stay in good relationships with everybody else.
Yes, people have also used the term social collateral for this, as opposed to, you know, physical capital used as collateral. But there are many, many interesting aspects, including that of reciprocity, where maybe I give you a loan and I charge low interest or no interest at all, because I'm expecting that you will reciprocate when I or my own offspring needs the loan. And in fact, when I studied credit transactions in Ghana, I found that the vast majority of the loans that were given from family members to other family members carried no interest whatsoever. And again, you can rationalize this with this concept of generalized reciprocity. We help each other, and this way, you know, I try to make sure that my family as a whole will have access to equally favorable terms for their loans when they need them.
So that's interesting. I mean, it's very much within the realm of sort of anthropology and sociology that this kind of kinship arrangement is studied, but it has this incredibly economic element to it as well, right?
Yes, it does. And, you know, part of what makes this multidisciplinary approach so interesting to me is that basically you never stop learning. You start formalizing a concept with your own framework, but then you see that this similar concept has been understood through a different lens in another discipline, and this can give you insights.
So were you able to bring something new to the discussion because of that methodological approach?
So, for example, I think this insight that, you know, you might see zero interest rate, which in economics doesn't make much sense, right? If you hold money and you can invest it and earn an interest, why should you give a loan at zero interest? This wouldn't be rationalized unless we take this notion that, okay, it seems as if you're losing money today, but by setting up an equilibrium or a norm where even when your own kids are asking for a loan, they themselves get a zero interest, you're actually not losing money. So this merging the reciprocity concept, which is coming from anthropology, into the credit and game theoretic model, I think allowed me to explain how an apparently irrational or suboptimal behavior could actually be optimal.
Yeah, interesting. Now, some of your work also shows that the fact that you have this very strong social norm between families, you know, that you have to sort of redistribute to your extended family, can kind of work against economic development, right?
Yeah, there's actually a literature that has looked at these family tax, as it's often described.
Oh, yeah.
And that is, you know, helping each other in times of need is great. But if I get discouraged from investing and saving because I'm afraid that other people will come and ask for money, this is going to generate a lower growth rate.
Right.
In my own research, one of the things I studied was actually how the obligations that were coming from family, more in terms of intergenerational transmission of property, were constraining or affecting behavior. And again, in the case of Ghana, there are groups where inheritance follows the paternal line, and this is what we are mostly familiar with. It's the so-called patrilineal system.
Right, so fathers carry on to the son.
Exactly. That's what we take as the default. But it turns out that in the world, there are groups that have, you know, forever been matrilineal. And in these groups, what counts is the mother's family. So this doesn't mean that women inherit from women. They're very often still societies where land and assets stay with the men. But the man from whom a boy will inherit is not his father, but his maternal uncle. So this boy is really tied to the family of the mother more than to the family of the father. Hmm. This is a quite an interesting tradition, but it has implications because if fathers want to make sure that their own kids have enough to live on in the future, in case they don't really trust their brother-in-laws to bequeath enough land, they have to make different types of investments. And so I found that basically what was happening in these matrilineal groups in Ghana was that they were investing in education more than the other groups. And education is something that you take with you, right? Wherever you go. It's not something that for which you will depend on your maternal uncle at the end of his days. And so what happened in Ghana was that once the law was changed, because the government wanted to give a bit more insurance to the families that they could actually bequeath part of their wealth to their own offspring, this right. made it less important for fathers to invest in their sons' wealth. And so they rebalanced by decreasing investment in education relative to other groups. Of course, education has been increasing over time, but it had increased much faster for these matrilineal groups in the past. And then once they could bequeath assets, they changed that portfolio. So this is, again, a pattern of behavior that is very relevant because eventually, you know, the future mobility prospects of these groups depends on these types of investments. But if we did not know enough about inheritance and lineage and customs, whether patrilinear or matrilinear, it would be difficult to understand what was going on.
So when you first began working as an economist in Africa, what were you hoping your work would do? I mean, did you have a certain objective in mind?
Well, you know, in the most optimistic scenario, I was hoping to find some answers to questions related to, you know, why the standards of living don't improve as fast as one would want. And so possibly also think about policy solutions and contribute in that sense. But often I've also told myself that if my work were just useful to call attention to certain problems, that would be enough. So, for example, some of the papers that I've written on a different line of research, a line of research more related to conflict, I think really the goal there was to bring to the surface issues that we often don't discuss enough. So
what do you mean? Like, can you give me an example?
Yeah, so one example comes from work that I've done and published on Angola, and that looks at what happened when the civil war ended. So Angola had been plagued by a civil war for basically 20 years. And this suddenly ended when the leader of the rebel movement, Jonas Savimbi, was killed in an ambush. And if you think about mainstream economic models, you would say, okay, war is bad for investment because it creates uncertainty. When this war is over, because everybody understood that the death of this very charismatic leader would immediately lead to a truce and peace, then you should expect firms to thrive.
Right.
And I looked at what happened to the stock prices of mining firms in Angola, who were active in Angola in those years, in particular in the diamond mining industry. And instead of going up, those stock prices went down when Savimbi died. Okay, so this means that investors thought, oh, this is bad news instead of being good news.
Right.
And what was going on? Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that this war was acting a bit as a barrier to entry because not many firms want to go and work in a country that is, subject to continuous instability. So those firms that were in the country were actually making extra profits. Yeah. They could get licenses at very convenient terms because right. the government wouldn't bargain so hard, given that not many firms were willing to come. They could also shade deals with the rebels that were mining diamonds illegally. So all of this created a situation where the few firms that were already working in the country were actually maybe, in a sense, benefiting from the instability.
Right. Making extra profit.
I guess what I wanted to put out there is the notion that if we're counting on incumbent firms, firms that are already working in these conflict economies, to be the drivers of change in the sense of working for peace, we cannot take it for granted, because in some sectors, it might be that their own interests actually do not really lead them to work for peace. And now I'm working on the mining firms in DRC and trying to see what happens to, you know, the activity of armed bands that are really all over the country. It's a terrible situation where these armed bands are very violent with civilians as well as among themselves. And again, it doesn't look as if the mineral production by these firms is particularly hurt by the presence of these bands. And then again, in some cases, there could be situations where they end up working side by side. The bands are effectively providing security for these mining activities to continue. So this is something that if you read reports by advocacy groups, even UN reports have documented it, but there is not much economic research on it. And so I try to use whatever data I find to shed some light on these aspects.
Wow, that's fascinating. So some of the other research that you've done that I've found really interesting looks at entertainment, like TV shows, right? To see how effective they can be, could be, in educating and also changing people's behavior, right?
Yes, that's something that I've also always been fascinated by, how what we see in the media, on television, shapes our beliefs, our expectations, our plans for the future. And over the years, I've gone from simply trying to understand what the existing media programs do to behavior, to actually working with the producers to create media programs that might actively change behavior in a way that's conducive to social and economic development.
Welcome to MTV Sugar Down South.
So we work with the World Bank and with the MTV Staying Alive Foundation to evaluate the impact of Sugar, which is a TV series produced and filmed in Africa to prevent HIV and also to reduce stigma towards HIV-positive people. And this is a typical MTV product, very well done, but also depicting a youth that's interesting in going to clubs.
The last time I checked, you were in Lagos.
My parents thought it
has a very, upbeat urban life. And then you see how these characters end up finding themselves in problematic health conditions because of taking enough precautions or not telling their friends about their status and so on. And so we designed a method to evaluate the impact of Sugar by basically screening it in small communities and small community centers before it went on TV, and comparing the reactions and people's behavior to individuals who had seen another show that wasn't Sugar. And we found very encouraging results when it came to knowledge about HIV, testing, And also a reduction is sexually transmitted infections. We were less successful when it came to condom use, in the sense that even though the content of the program was very explicitly, you know, recommending that people use protection, we didn't find effects on that particular dimension.
Why do you think that was a limitation?
Well, another message, which was the one of trying to avoid concurrent partnerships, or at least reduce the number of partners, that message went through.
Yeah.
And so, in fact, the reduction in STDs that we found was probably linked to that. These are behaviors that are not very easy to change. And there have been many attempts with top-down approaches and education campaigns that have failed. This is a bit more subtle, because the idea here is not to lecture people. It's more to, you know, show them and have them draw their own conclusions on how to behave. But then again, of course, there are limitations to the approach itself, because you still need to keep the show engaging, entertaining, and, you know, show some risky behavior at the same time.
Right.
And so we didn't take it for granted that it would work, because it could be that the educational message got lost into the plot.
Right.
And instead it seemed to have stuck with the viewers.
Well, Eliana LaFerrara, what a pleasure it's been to have the chance to talk to you about your work. And I thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you. The pleasure has been mine.
Eliana LaFerrara is a professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. She was speaking with Rhoda Metcalf. Look for the other podcasts in our Women in Economics series at imf.org/podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at imf_podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.